Hello, and welcome to episode number 101 of the Point of Convergence podcast. As always, I am your host, Exoacademian. When it comes to the intelligences behind the UFO phenomenon, a certain group of repeating players tend to draw most of the attention. These commonly referenced groups include the Greys, the Nordics, the Reptilians, and the Mantis types. And while there are a considerable number of accounts that do indeed refer to these particular beings, this can sometimes lead to the erroneous conclusion that they represent the sum total of the NHI we are dealing with. The truth is, when one peruses the full breadth of the experiencer literature, it becomes clear that a plethora of alien beings are actually encountered, and even within the types that resemble the most commonly referenced, there seem to be numerous nuances in their appearance and behavior, only further complicating the picture, suggesting perhaps both species, subspecies, as well as factioning. While it is a human tendency to prefer concise, that is to say, manageable answers, especially when it comes to an exploration of the unknown reaches of our knowledge, we should be careful not to reduce the complexity encountered in order to simply lighten cognitive load. I would suggest a more helpful response would be to embrace the rich diversity represented in the many types of non-human intelligences that we, on occasion, seem to cross paths with, even if this does require a significant upgrade in our understanding of the complexity of our cosmic environment. To this point, in today's episode, we're going to be making our third trek into the stellar work of Artie Sixkiller Clark, an academic of Native American descent who's contributed greatly to our collective awareness of these various forms of non-human intelligence. Our collective knowledge of the variety and nature of these beings has been greatly aided through Clark's dedicated, tireless, and methodical cataloging of the many kinds of beings encountered specifically amongst people of indigenous descent. Do certain kinds of apparently alien beings tend to interact with specific types of human people groups? And if so, do these data points perhaps represent overarching patterns, providing hints even in regards to differing human origins? To that point, how should we make sense of the claims of descent from such beings which are so often part of indigenous cultural lore? It is the expansive and unique work of people like Artie Sixkiller Clark that helps us to begin to address just such questions. Just how wide-ranging are the alien types encountered? And where do these various types fall within the spectrum of consciousness development, respectively? These are just a few of the questions we'll seek to engage with in this, the 101st episode of the Point of Convergence podcast. As we begin this week's podcast, I would just like to point out that if you would like to support this podcast, and in so doing gain access to all of my content, which now includes not just Point of Convergence and Liminal Frames and Event Horizon, a new podcast I began with a new co-host, Janice, just this last week, as well as access to my Discord server and discounts on online courses and retreats, as well as access to my bonus material, which includes the podcast's OTC Squared, as well as the various feature series I create, you can do so by going to patreon.com/exoacademian or by subscribing on Spotify. All right, with that preamble aside, let's get into this week's episode. As I mentioned in the introduction, in this week's episode, we're going to be diving back into Artie Sixkiller Clark's outstanding work. This time we'll be pulling from and reflecting on accounts recorded in her book, More Encounters with Star People, Urban American Indians Tell Their Stories. Now we're going to be jumping into these accounts pretty quickly here, but I first just want to make a few points about Artie's work in general. Number one, as I've said on previous podcasts we've done on her work, she gets to accounts that others don't. And this is because she focuses on accounts recorded in indigenous history. She seeks out American Indians as well as Indians and people of Native descent in different parts of the world and is able to record verbatim these accounts and share them with the rest of the world. Now, I want to note here that she has unique access to these kinds of people because often they do not want to share these stories with outsiders, but because she's of Native American descent herself, she's not seen as an outsider, And because she's been a professor in academia, she is also recognized with respect in those communities because of how she's represented them amongst the larger human community. Another thing I want to make note of here, and this again relates to the data itself, is that many of these accounts refer to a self-understanding amongst some of these people groups that they indeed descend from some of the beings they encounter. Now, in today's episode, many of these encounters will not involve those specific beings, and that's one of the interesting points, that many of these people of American Indian descent actually differentiate between the beings they've encountered in these particular accounts versus the beings that are understood as being the progenitors of their species. So this is very, very interesting, and it kind of flies in the face of modern science, but this is part of the lore that perhaps we don't yet recognize the biomarkers that would point in this direction, but it's worth noting and not easily dismissing the fact that it is part of their self-understanding for many of these indigenous groups that they indeed descend from some of these quote-unquote star people. Another thing I want to point out is that what's really interesting about her work is that we see, again, a vast array of different kinds of beings. That helps us understand that it's not just a few of the usual types that are being encountered here. There's also a spectrum of consciousness on display amongst these different groups. And that speaks to the fact, again, that I see it less as this being about good versus evil beings and more about beings that demonstrate different levels of maturity along a spectrum of consciousness development. We see that on display clearly in the range of encounters we're going to discuss today. Another thing I really appreciate about her work is that she doesn't cherry pick or edit to fit a pre-existing agenda or preference. She just tells the accounts as they are said to her. She records these accounts and then recounts those verbatim in these books. Last point I'd like to make in regards to most of these accounts, if not all of them, is that there's incredible psychic powers being displayed by these various non-human intelligences. Now, of course, we understand that human beings also have these capacities, otherwise we would not be able to understand these telepathic communications. And perhaps we have dormant capacities that are quite tremendous if we ever are able to bring those online. And again, that might be part of the evolutionary curve we are currently on. And of course, the fact that all kinds of beings, all kinds of sentient life seem to be able to communicate telepathically and read information from the field, not just from different beings, but from the environment itself, speaks to the ultimate nature of reality as really being an expression of different modulations of consciousness. Now, before we jump into the first account from this book, I want to share this one reflection that Artie shares in the beginning of the book. She says, quote, "Unlike encounters with star people, untold stories of American Indians that dealt with stories of American Indians on reservations, this book will concentrate on stories of American Indians who live off reservations. There are 576 federally recognized American Indian tribes living on 324 Indian reservations in the United States. Of the 5 billion full-bloods or mixed-race American Indians, 78% live among the public. The majority of full-blooded Indians live on their reservations," unquote. Now that we understand which particular subgroup of American Indians Artie is going to focus on in this book, let's jump into the first account. Quote, "Nestled near the border of Montana and Canada is the Writing on the Stone Park, which is located in the province of Alberta, Canada. The park contains the greatest concentration of rock art on the North American Great Plains. There are over 50 petroglyph sites and thousands of other works that date to 9,000 BCE. The pictographs and petroglyphs of Writing on the Stone are both ceremonial and biographical in nature. Some depict crests, headdresses, and sunbursts, and others display accounts of successful hunts, heroic battles, and fallen enemies. Blackfeet legends suggest the paintings and glyphs are the work of the spirit world. I first learned of this site from a Blackfeet graduate student who told me about the unique events that often occurred at the site. He said there was one account of an individual who stepped into a time portal, went back in time, and saw Blackfeet Indian village as it was before the coming of the white man. There have also been reports of frequent UFO sightings in the area," unquote. And now let's pick up the story when she has an interesting encounter with a certain man. Quote, "Tell me, Dr. Clark, do you believe in UFOs? I stopped dead in my tracks at his question. Why do you ask? You said you traveled the back roads of Montana, following up on stories. I thought you'd heard about the UFOs that come here. This is the place where the old ones come and go, he said. This is a place where you can travel the universal highway. Who are the old ones? I asked. There are many stories of the spirits and the star people who visit this place. People often come here to connect with them. Is that why you are here? I asked. I come here for many reasons. She continues by saying, I have been told there is a portal here, and if you walk through it, you travel to another time. Do you know of such a place? I asked. There is such a portal. It's not always open. You have to be in the right place at the right time, Tom replied. Do you have a clue when it opens? Is there a pattern? As far as I can determine, there is no pattern. It's random. I come here to see the UFOs. Sometimes they appear, other times they don't appear. They travel the universal highway. One day when the portal appears, I will walk through it. Have you seen UFOs here? I asked. Yes, sometimes they land in the valley below. Sometimes they just come to visit. What do you mean they come to visit? The star travelers stop and visit with me. And what do they look like? I asked. Like me, but not so Indian, he laughed. Some look like Indians, though. How often do you come here? I asked. I used to come here with my grandfather. He was a spiritual man. Some called him a healer. The starman came here to visit him. I was a young kid back then and would often fall asleep while they visited. It was normal to me. I knew nothing else. He walked towards his pickup and retrieved two folding camp chairs. He sat one down and suggested I should sit. He unfolded the other one and sat down next to me. And then eventually their conversation turns again to the portals. And he adds, yes, there are other places like this in the world. There is a place in Peru. I hope to go there one day. There is one in Mexico and one in Bolivia. There is one in Alaska. Several others, but mostly they stay hidden. Only those who have traveled the Universal Highway know of their existence. There is a place in Iraq. My unit was deployed there and I came upon it by accident. A star traveler saved my life there. I'm not sure I understand. How did a star traveler save your life in Iraq? How did you find the portal? When 9/11 occurred, I was angry. I was living in Los Angeles at the time. I quit my job and joined the Army. I was 30, single, with no real direction. I decided to do something for my country. My friends thought I was crazy, but I believed that our country was at war, like the president and his cronies led us to believe. Little did I know that it was propaganda mixed in with showmanship. I did not ask him about his last statement. I had heard similar comments from veterans who believed they were misled by the rumors of weapons of mass destruction. So you ended up in Iraq? Yes, a few months later, I was in Iraq. The war had been going on for a few weeks when my unit arrived. We were immediately dispatched to a town in the desert. Word had arrived that Saddam Hussein had been spotted there. When we arrived, it was an ambush. I hunkered down next to an abandoned building when suddenly I was peppered with gunfire from above. As I looked for safety, I stumbled into a corridor of an abandoned building. Suddenly, sand began to swirl from the floor and a tunnel opened. I entered the passageway and was greeted by a human-like being who indicated he could lead me to safety. I followed him down a long, narrow tunnel. We arrived at an underground opening the size of a dozen football fields, and in the center of it was a spacecraft. It was wonderful there. The heat of the desert was stifling, but it was cool and clean and clear inside the passageway. I walked forward, and the being said I should go with him, and they would take me to safety. Do you mean that he offered to take you away from the war? Yes, he offered to return me to my home. I told my rescuer that I must return to my unit. My absence would be considered desertion. What was his reaction to that? He did not understand why I would voluntarily put myself into harm's way, but he honored my decision. As he left, the starman said they would return the next day at the same time and wait for me if I changed my mind. Did you change your mind? It was tempting, he said, leaning over and picking up a rock from between his feet. I realized at the time that I had stepped into the portal to the Universal Highway in the middle of the Iraqi desert. I was not surprised, though. All the portals are in desolate places. Tell me what you know about the Universal Highway. It's real. There are places all over the world that are sacred. These places were often the portals to the Universal Highway, but as centuries passed and populations moved or were destroyed, people forgot about them. They are like a network of invisible sky roads that lead across the Milky Way to other worlds. The Maya knew about these portals, so did the Inca. Many American Indian tribes knew too. That is how the UFOs come here. That is how they leave. Without the highway, they would be unable to travel such long distances in such little time. Your story is interesting. I met a man in Hawaii many years ago. He said there was a portal in Maui near a waterfall. He said he had traveled it many times. I went there with him, even camped out a couple of days, but the portal never opened. Like I said, you have to be in the right place at the right time. There are portals throughout the world. There is one in Navajo country. It's near Chinle. There is one in Arkansas and another one in West Virginia. There are three in Nevada near the area known as Area 51, as well as one in Dulce, New Mexico. And then jumping a little bit ahead in the narrative, Artie returns to this question about the being he met in Iraq. Quote, "The alien you met in Iraq, what did he look like? He looked like you and me. They are us. They come to Earth and mingle with the people. I traveled one year and I returned from Iraq with one of them. We hitchhiked all over Montana, Wyoming, and the Dakotas. We were taken in by brothers on several reservations and participated in ceremonies. Everyone understood he was a star traveler, but he knew his identity was safe with us. Why do they come here? At one time, the Earth was their home, but they moved on to other places. Sometimes they just come to visit. They tell me there are hundreds of living stars. Those who went in search of another home are those who travel the universal highway and return to visit us. They walk among us all the time. No one can detect the difference. Can you detect the difference? Let me ask you a question. Have you ever met someone who is calm in the face of adversity, someone who is always kind and looked for good in all situations? Of course, I've met a few. Then you've probably met a star traveler." And then Artie asks him, "What about those who are alleged to have abducted humans and conducted experiments on them? Are they us too?" "There are many species in this great universe, Dr. Clark. They too travel the universal highway. There is no control over that. Some of the species who visit Earth have other agendas. So humans are not the only species in the universe capable of horrible deeds. According to the star travelers I have met, that is true." "Did your grandfather know of this highway?" "Yes, he traveled it many times. When I was about 8 years old, he took me with him. If it had not been for my grandfather, I probably would never have understood what happened to me in Iraq." Unquote. Now, a few really interesting points to touch on in that account. Number one, this notion of portals. Now, it's interesting because in modern television, we are seeing with Skinwalker Ranch frequent reference to these kinds of portals. And we have people of pretty astounding credibility, people like Colm Kelleher, who are talking about these notions of portals apparently appearing in midair over the ranch, and that different researchers there have seen different beings climb out of that portal, beings that seem to be from other places that look like aliens, other kinds of beings that look more like what is so-called a dino beaver, creatures that seem to be from Earth, but perhaps from a different time on Earth. So all that is to say, this notion of portals is not unique to these stories alone. I've also heard about some places like this. I did a podcast episode called The Other World Gates that talked about thin places across the planet where these portals are still apparently there and sometimes active. Indeed, I was briefed one time about just such a portal that exists in the Patagonia region of South America and that different beings have been observed coming through there. It also happens to be a very, very windy area and quite remote, so not many people are around to see this happen, and again, perhaps that's by design. Now, I understand some people might think this sounds far-fetched, but again, we have even credible researchers with PhDs and whatnot recounting experiences with just these kinds of portals. Last point to make here is that this person here points out that different kinds of beings come here along a spectrum of consciousness development. In other words, some are highly evolved and basically demonstrate a non-dual transpersonal understanding where they are very kind, they are very calm, and they understand the interconnected nature of all sentient life. But there are also beings, somewhat like many human beings, who are more self-centered and still focusing on the illusion of separation between different beings. In the raw contact material, which I've mentioned several times, this is referred to as beings who have an orientation of service to self versus service to others. So again, we do see this represented in these different kinds of accounts here. There's a range of consciousness development. And if you hear people trying to reduce the complexity of the UFO phenomenon, not only to a few groups of beings, but on top of that, it being either all good or all evil, then they are really, I would argue, engaging in wishful thinking rather than really paying attention to the data itself. Now, in that first account, we referenced a being that looked human, that looked just like us, that could walk amongst us, that does, in fact, walk among us, according to this person, which goes to show that ontological shock is not always part of the picture here. In the next account, we're going to hear from someone who also encountered beings that looked, at least, human to him. An interesting additional wrinkle about this particular account, though, is that these human-looking beings he encountered were apparently made from his own genetic material. Let's jump into that account now. Quote, after being seated, John explained, the brothers have been coming to me since I was 5 years old. They were 5 years old, too. We lived in a small village on the Choctaw Reservation. I used to wander off by myself when I was a small boy. My father was absent most of the time. My mother worked to keep food on the table and a roof over our heads. My older brother, who was 12, was supposed to take care of me. There was no money for babysitters. In the winter, when we went to school, I stayed at an elderly auntie's house. I remember her fondly. She smelled of cigarettes and clothes. So when you first met the brothers, they were 5, just like you? Where did you meet them? I played with them in the fields and trees. We liked to run and play hide and seek. In the afternoon, when we got tired, we would go to their home. It was cool and relaxing there, and we could rest and sleep. How many brothers did you have? I had 3 brothers. Everyone had 3 brothers, as I recall. Were there other children in the brothers' house? Oh, yes, yeah, sometimes 2 or 3 other kids. We were all the same age, I think. They each had 3 brothers, too. So were all the children Choctaw Indians? I never recognized any of them, so I don't know. I remember we were only allowed to play with our 3 brothers. We weren't allowed to play as a large group. How many years did you engage in this activity? Until I left the reservation. They came every summer, several times. In the winter, I seldom saw them. Didn't that seem strange to you? When I was 5, it didn't seem strange. I was happy to have friends. We loved each other like brothers. We took care of each other. I wasn't lonely when the brothers came. Did you ever tell your mother about the brothers? I asked. Oh, yes. She thought they were imaginary friends. I tried to explain that they came from the stars, but she thought my story quaint and imaginative, so I just gave up. How old were you when you realized that they were not your brothers? In a way, they were my brothers, but I think I was probably 8 when I realized that they really did not live on Earth and that they came from another world far beyond this galaxy. How did you come up with that conclusion? It was when I realized that their home was a spaceship. I know they lived on it, but for me, if you live somewhere, it was a house. I realized they only came to Earth to visit me. So how did that make you feel? At first, confused, then special. Now I feel blessed and honored to know that I am part of something much bigger. I look at the world differently now. I can watch these DC politicians tell their lies and cover up the truth about UFOs, but I know the truth. They can't fool me. Once you realized what was going on and that your brothers were from the stars, did you confront them? Yes, I told them I knew they weren't my real brothers like my brother Jack. They laughed and told me that they were just as related to me as Jack and wanted to know why I felt this way. I told them they lived on a spaceship, and if they were my real brothers, they would live with me in a house. That must have been very brave of you to say these things. Anyway, he continued, they explained to me that my blood and some of my tissue was taken and they made more of me. My brothers were actually triplets produced from my blood and tissue. Were they clones? I guess that's what you would call them. After you knew how the brothers came to be, did the visits stop? Actually, they increased. As I entered high school, they actually became quite frequent. What was their purpose on Earth? These individuals who were created to be my brothers were actually anthropologists. They were chosen at birth to follow this track and groomed to fulfill this role in life. Did they ever reveal to you their mission on Earth? They were doing what all anthropologists do. They were studying human behavior, but as humans. Can you explain? Yes, they looked like me, so they could go forth to different locations, blend in with the people, and live with them. Do you know what aspect of human nature they were studying? They focused a lot of attention on juvenile violence. They wanted to understand why human males became so violent. They were also interested in the horrible abuse that humans committed against infants and animals. Unquote. So very interesting account there. We hear not just about a kind of hybridization project or a notion of genetic augmentation, but actual clones that were made from the genetic material of this particular person. It's also interesting that they reference, in this particular case, human violence specifically amongst males. Now, there's going to be a very interesting account we get to later that talks about that in terms of how a new planet was apparently being seeded in such a way as to avoid the violent streak that they had noted specifically amongst human males. But we'll get to that account later. Let's first move on to our next account. In this next case, we're going to hear about human abduction as well as animal abduction, and this account will also reference what is commonly referred to as animal mutilation. So we often hear about these carcasses being discovered, but it's been mysterious how this is going on and what is actually instrumental in causing these kinds of injuries and deaths to various animals. This particular account perhaps sheds some light on how some of that is happening. Quoting from the book again, quote, "It was dark, very dark, but it is always dark in Alaska in the winter. I was working with a team of engineers and some Alaskan native electrical power techs brought in to do the grunt work. It was cold. I think one of the guys said it was 74 below zero. It doesn't matter when it gets that cold anyway. Machines break in the cold. Pieces shear off from the cold. Wires break. It was a frustrating night. We finally decided to call it a night and meet up 8 hours later. I sent the others home while I put away the equipment. I had my own transportation and my vehicle was running. I was not worried about getting stranded or expecting anything eventful to happen to me." So were you alone when the first encounter took place? "Yes, I was headed for my vehicle. I had turned off all the work lights, and just as the last one went dark, the whole surroundings lit up like the 4th of July. Red lights, blue lights, white lights shined down on the snow, making the place look like a Christmas scene. I looked up to find out the origin of the lights, but they were blinding, particularly the one in the center. At the same time, I heard the recognizable cry of a polar bear. Running for my vehicle, I was suddenly thrown to the ground. I managed to turn onto my back just in time to see something that is almost indescribable. A polar bear was suspended in midair like a limp, stuffed animal. Its head rolled from side to side, and occasionally I would see it move all 4 feet like it was trying to run, and then it would go limp again as if it had given up the fight. Then it was gone into the white light." Are you telling me the polar bear was abducted? "At first I wasn't thinking that way. Then another polar bear came into view and the white light focused on it. The same thing again. The bear was bigger and resisted more, but it was useless. It was gone, sucked up into the white light like the first. I lay there thinking I must be delirious, but then I knew if I were delirious, I would not be questioning myself. After the white light disappeared, feeling returned to my body and I sat up, but not before seeing the outline of the circular craft that moved upward. Within seconds, it disappeared into the night sky. I immediately climbed into my vehicle and headed back to base camp." Unquote. And then he's going to jump forward in the narrative to when these dead polar bears are discovered. Quote, "Directly in front of an electrical shack was a dead polar bear, but it was not an ordinary death. The polar bear is at the top of the food chain in the animal world in Alaska. If one dies, it is the result of a terrible battle over a female with a stronger polar bear. However, this bear had not been brought down by its fellow species. It appeared as if it had suffered death at the hands of a surgeon, or at least it seemed that way. Its eyes had been removed and the ears. It was slit open and the heart had been removed along with the kidneys. The sexual organ had been removed and the tongue was gone. There was no blood on the snow. If the polar bear had died in battle, there would have been blood everywhere. It was clearly not a death at the hands of human hunters. They would have wanted the meat. What about the other bear? We found it about 100 yards away. Same thing, no blood and the body parts." Unquote. Now we're going to move forward in the narrative to where this person not only witnesses an abduction, but he becomes someone who is abducted. Quoting from the book again, "We had gone out one morning to secure a site where we had been working. While I checked the electrical connections, the workers set about installing a series of cameras, which are monitored minute by minute by some computer watchdog sitting in an office somewhere. We set up multiple cameras because if sabotage occurs, it is not likely that every camera can be disabled at the same time." Sabotage? What were you doing there? I already told you, it was top secret. Perhaps the nature of what we were doing was what drew the alien spaceship to the site. Who knows why they appeared at that site instead of 10 miles away where several polar bears with their cubs had been seen earlier that week. I finished checking the connections and was on the phone with a monitoring center checking the cameras as they were installed. Suddenly there was nothing but static on the line. I looked in the direction of the workers who were no more than 40 feet from me and they were gone. I called for them but no response. Within the next instant, I was on board a spaceship. At first, I didn't understand. I saw no craft, no lights, and no aliens. I was simply transported onto their craft. I was standing beside the two workers who appeared disoriented. One of them began to scream in terror as four creatures approached us. Were they humanoid? Human forms in that they had two legs and two arms and a head, but they were like midgets. They were small, bow-legged, and strong. The Inupiat are small themselves, but they towered over the creatures by at least a foot or more. Can you describe their faces? Their heads were large for their bodies, like they had a disease. I remember a kid back in my village in North Carolina who had a big head. My mother said he was born with water on the brain. He died when he was about 8. Their heads were like his. This is what they looked like. Big brains encompassed in hairless skin the color of powder. They wore huge black goggles that wrapped around their heads, hiding their eyes. I suspected the goggles were some type of computerized equipment. Did the creatures take you to another area? Yes, they took us to another level. How did they do that? There was an elevator of sorts, a round tube that took us up from one level to another. Were all three of you together? Yes. When we arrived on the upper level, we were in a dome-like room. There were others there, too. From the looks of them, we were all native, but not native like Alaska natives. I think they had tribal people from many nations. I worked with a Lakota and a Blackfeet Indian in Vietnam. I would swear that they were Blackfeet Indians, Lakota Sioux, Cherokee, Choctaw, and other tribes as well. Were there any non-indigenous? None that I saw. What do you think they were interested in native people for? I asked them that question. They said because we were different. Clearly there is something in our DNA which has escaped our scientists. That makes us unique. Were these the small men or were you talking with others? No, the small men were the guardians, the captors, and the police force. The scientists who were conducting the experiments were similar in appearance to humans. They ranged in height from about 5'7" to 6 feet. Their skin was the color of mine, like a constant suntan, I guess. Did they have any other distinguishing characteristics? Broad foreheads. What do you mean by broad foreheads? I should have said their heads were bigger at the top and smaller at the chin. Anything else? Not that I recall. Okay, so you are now in the dome-like room. Tell me how you came to talk to the scientists, as you call them. I started counting the men in the room. They were all men. I thought if I kept my mind busy, they could not control me. The others seemed to be in a trance, disoriented, almost lifeless. They walked around and around. So as not to appear different, I walked with them, all the time counting. How many did you count? 71 before they removed me. Where did they take you? To another level, but this time it was down one level. I was led into a room filled with strange equipment. Their technology was nothing like I had ever seen. They led me to a tube that had a light that ran up and down my body. It made the hairs of my body stand up, and the sensation was not as uncomfortable as it was ticklish. They did this several times. I demanded to know what they were doing. What was their reaction? I saw none, but the strangest thing happened is that I was able to communicate with them. All I had to do was think about something, and I would immediately know the answer. How did you do that? I'm not sure. When I asked a question, they answered it. They could read my mind. Did they speak? No, I knew the answer in my head, telepathy. I know I sound like some quack job, but that's exactly what happened. I assure you I am sane. You are not the only person who has told me about communicating telepathically with aliens. They told me they were surprised that I had not been affected by their drugs. What drugs? As I understand, they have a compound, I called it a drug, in their atmosphere that induces lethargy in humans. When humans are put into their atmosphere, they become like zombies. They said only one human in 20,000 is immune. I must have been one of them because I was aware of everything that was going on. Do you remember anything about the atmosphere in the room that was unusual? There was a mist that emanated from the walls. Did they answer your questions freely? They did answer my questions, but I always had the feeling they were guarded in their answers. In other words, I do not think they told me the whole truth. Do you have any basis for that belief? A gut feeling. Did they tell you why you were placed in the tube? They were checking for diseases, abnormalities. They said that too many humans suffer from unchecked diseases. They did not want the blood of those who were contaminated. They had to protect their samples and specimens. Specimens? What kind of specimens? I asked them that question, but they told me it had nothing to do with my visit. Visit? Yes, they called their abductions a visit from humans. What other experiments did they perform? They took blood and sperm. They placed a helmet apparatus on my head. They said it allowed them to transfer all of my knowledge to their databanks. I told them they had no right to do that, and they responded that I had no right to refuse. What other questions did you ask them? The obvious, where do you live? They told me in a galaxy far beyond our telescopes or probes. I asked them if they believed in God. They said that God was in all living beings. They were aware of Jesus and said his teachings were appropriate for universal truths. I asked them if they lived in family units. They said only breeders lived in family units. Breeders? Yes, those selected to have children. They control population growth on their planet very carefully. It seems as if they have been able to extend life to nearly 1,000 years. But in doing so, they can only allow so many children to be born a year. It is equal to the number who die. So they do die. Not as you and I will die. They choose death when they no longer feel they can be contributing members of society. What else did you ask them? I asked them how long they had been traveling the universe. They said for over 40,000 Earth years. When I asked them how they propelled their machines, they said the forces of the universe. There was no fuel as we know it. The universe contained the propulsion energy, but it would be centuries before our scientists learned those secrets. What about diseases? Did you ask about that? I did. They said all living creatures in the universe have the ability to heal themselves. They said in the early days of humans, they had the power, but the power was taken away. But they said that was one of the secrets of the universe and a question I should ask myself. Did you come away with any overall impression of how they felt about humans? I asked them about their impression of the human race and if they believed we would survive. They said we were the strongest of the species that lived on our planet in that we had learned to dominate the animal and plant kingdoms, but in terms of the universe, we were weak creatures. Did you ask them what gave them the right to abduct humans? They said that they had the right because in the universe, they were a dominant species. When I responded by accusing them of treating us like animals, their response was that our evolutionary status was that of an animal. This made me angry, and I demanded to know why they wanted the sperm of an animal. One of them stepped forward and said, "Because you were once one of us. You had the same opportunity to choose a different path, but your path was one of destruction. Your idea of progress took a different evolutionary path than us. We chose to value life and knowledge. You did not." Unquote. Now, as we prepare to move on to the next account, I would just ask us to reflect about the way that we treat animals and at the same time demonstrate this outrage when certain alien groups seem to regard us as more like animals in many ways than we are like really advanced, sophisticated creatures. We have to be careful, I would suggest, to not exercise a double standard when we think about these things, and we should think about the animal life on the planet if we really want to be taken seriously in our demands of these other creatures and how they treat us, at least some of them. Now, in this next account, we're going to talk about a seeding of a planet that was done in such a way as to avoid the aggressive tendencies that are typical of human males. Let's jump into that account now. One evening, I was driving home. It was winter, so it was dark. I had stopped off to pick up dinner and Sherry from the Montessori school. She was only two, but they allowed two-year-olds in the program 3 days a week. On other days, my mother took care of her. I was on the road headed home when I saw a stationary light up ahead near the highway. Although it appeared low to the ground, I thought it was a plane from the airbase. Then as I got closer, I realized it was not a plane. The light was motionless. What did you do? I knew there had to be some rational explanation, so I drove toward the light. It never occurred to me that I was dealing with a UFO. When did you realize it was a UFO? I was driving along and suddenly the blinding light disappeared, but at the same time my headlights went out. Then the dashboard lights faded and the car stopped. Fortunately, I guided the car to the side of the road when the headlights went out. I got out of the car, unstrapped Sherry from her car seat, and decided to walk. We were no more than a mile from the house. The night was clear and the moon was bright. I told myself I could make it. But at this point, do you know there is a UFO? No, I just think I'm having a streak of bad luck. I was long overdue for a new car and I'd had similar problems with it. So what did you do? I decided that instead of walking down the highway, I would cut through the neighbor's field. I thought I could cut a quarter mile off the walk, and Sherry was a little heavy to carry a mile. I was about halfway across the field when the light returned. This time I realized it was no plane or helicopter. A light searched the ground all around us. When it fell on us, it stopped. The next thing I know, I'm on board a spacecraft, and I don't know how I got there. And Sherry? She's with me, but they are telling me she doesn't belong to me. Who is telling you? I don't know. They are saying she belongs to them. I remember screaming at the top of my lungs at the voices in my head. Did you see them? Fleeting glimpses, nothing more. Then what happened? They returned me to Earth. In fact, they placed me in front of my door with Sherry in my arms. And you aren't going to believe this. My car was parked in the driveway. I know it sounds impossible, but it is true. I sat on the doorstep and cried. Sherry was trying to comfort me, but at that moment, seeing my car in the driveway, I knew how powerful they were. Sorry, I get a little emotional when I think about that night. Is there anything I can do? She shook her head. I'm okay, it's just that I'm emotional. When you hear the rest of the story, you will understand. Have you seen them since that first incident? Many times. The next time was when Sherry was four. It was the same. But this time, instead of walking through the fields, I stayed on the highway and they took us on board their ship. They took Sherry from me and the same chilling voice filled my head and told me that Sherry was not mine. Afterwards, the two of us would be in the car with the engine running. I began to think I was losing my mind. Did they ever say anything else to you? Yes, when Sherry was six, they took us. It was like clockwork. Every 2 years at the beginning, then every year after that. Was their communication different after she was six? Yes, that year it was different. They took us into a room, and there they repeated what they had been telling me, that Sherry was not my daughter. They explained that I only provided a means for her birth on Earth. They reminded me how I had been told by doctors that I could not have children. Was that true? Yes, my husband Dean and I had been trying to have children for 7 years and nothing happened. A few months before he was killed in a car accident, I got pregnant. These aliens, these star people or whatever you call them, said they knew how much I wanted a child, so they gave me one, but only to keep while she was a child. When she became a woman, she was to go with them. Did they tell you when she would become a woman? When she is 17. She is 14 now. I only have her for 3 more years, and then she will be gone. I don't know what I'm going to do. Do you think if I move away from here, they will not find me? I've been thinking about New Mexico or Oklahoma. There are many Indians there. Maybe I can lose myself in the desert. I don't know what I'll do without my baby. After a few moments, she wiped her tears. I'm sorry. I needed to talk with you. Has anyone else ever told you a similar story in Indian country? Never. I have never heard anything even slightly related. I'm so frightened of losing my baby, she said. Mary, I think you need to talk to a psychologist. Perhaps it would help you get through these events. So you don't believe me? No, Mary, I didn't say that. I knew I shouldn't say anything. They warned me.
What do you mean they warned you?
They said if I told anyone, they wouldn't believe me.
Mary, it's not that I don't believe you, but I think someone could help you deal with this. You need a friend.
I wanted you to be my friend.
I am your friend, and I will help you in any way I can.
For the next 4 months, I talked with Mary weekly on the phone. Although her main story stayed the same, occasionally she elaborated. On the next visit in the Southwest, I stayed at Mary's house outside Phoenix. I had no sooner walked into her home than she began to share additional information about the UFO travelers. They told me they were collecting young women from all over the world. They are the same age as Sherry.
Why?
They haven't told me yet. All I know is that single mothers have raised all the girls. They have no relatives except a grandmother. No siblings, no cousins, no fathers. But there must be a reason. They just have not told me yet.
But you seem to be calmer. Are you accepting the situation?
Sherry tells me I have nothing to worry about. She said they told her that I would always be with her. Sherry believes them. She thinks it is an adventure.
Do you believe them?
I don't know, so I don't think about it.
6 months later, I was in Phoenix. I stayed at Mary's over the weekend. Mary's mother was visiting a friend on the reservation, and Sherry had a sleepover with a friend in the city.
I have something to tell you, Mary said. My mother talks about meeting them.
Are you telling me that your mother, Pearl, is being abducted by the aliens?
Yes.
Why?
I'm not sure. They haven't told me. And if Mother knows, she doesn't tell me. I do know that she appears younger and healthier.
Tell me about that.
It's hard to explain, but I know she gets around better. She can go out and walk with me at Walmart and Costco. The doctor has taken her off of her high blood pressure and diabetes medicine.
Has she changed her diet?
Yes, she has become a vegetarian. So has Sherry. I can't get into it. I still like my roast beef and hamburgers.
And then Artie continues, I didn't see Mary for 8 months. Sherry was now 16. When I told her I was coming to Phoenix the following week, I could have sworn she thought my visit would be an inconvenience, but I said nothing. When I showed up on her doorstep, she welcomed me with a smile. In my absence, she had lost about 50 pounds. While I marveled at her transformation, she bounced around the kitchen like a teenager. I watched as she poured a glass of white wine and offered me one.
I will miss wine, she said.
What do you mean? I asked.
They said I can go too.
I saw the excitement on her face.
When did they tell you?
4 months ago. They told me I had to prepare myself, thus the weight loss.
She stood and twirled around the kitchen floor, showing off her new body.
I had to give up all meat, only vegetables and fruit. You should try it, she said.
Why did you make these changes?
Where we are going, there will be no meat. We will live on fruits and vegetables.
Tell me exactly what they told you.
They told me to get my things in order, because if I wanted to go with Sherry, I was welcome to go. Even my mother is being invited.
Mary, do you know what you are doing?
What have they told you?
Not much, but it is for a good reason.
I don't understand.
They don't want us talking about it, but I'm taking a chance with you. Don't write about this until I'm gone. Promise.
I promise.
This is what they explained to me. They call themselves Seeders. They travel the universe looking for livable planets. Once they find one, if it is devoid of life, they populate it. They have tried populating planets with adults from Earth, but their experiments never worked out. They have discovered that adult males often take violence, vengeance, and greed and take them to another planet. So they have decided to select women with no relatives other than a grandmother to help them become pregnant with a hybrid baby and take them to another planet. And then Artie inquires as to whether or not Sherry is a hybrid baby.
Not exactly. Sherry is 100% human. She is Dean's daughter and my daughter. But she has also been implanted with some of their DNA. They just made her birth possible to a childless couple who wanted a daughter, but at the same time wanted to see if they could influence human behavior. They decided the female was more acceptable for this test than the male.
What would have happened if Dean had lived? Would they have taken him too?
I don't think so. Women will only populate this planet. They will take care of procreation without men. We will develop a society, a world free of war and hatred.
What will happen in this world when baby boys are born?
I asked them the same question. They said they want to make sure no boys were born. This is an experiment. Do you think you will be happy in such a world? I do. I look around and I see that men cause 90% of the pain, heartache, and violence. I see women working every day to support men. I see men taking their money and spending it on alcohol and drugs. Oh yes, it is definitely a world I would like to join. My mother too. Mary, I'm worried about this. Are you sure you know what you're doing? And what about Sherry? Don't you want her to grow up here among her friends and go to college and marry? Sherry wants to go. She has already made friends with some of the girls who will go on the trip with us. She's excited. But you're her mother. Yes, and that's why I'm going. I can't lose my baby. I have no choice. For a moment, I thought I noted sadness in her voice. But then in an instant, she changed into the exuberant person who met me at the front door. I wanted to wait to tell you all this, but I will be leaving soon. What about your house? I've already taken care of that. I've given it to a charity that helps young Indian girls. They will take possession in 2 months. 2 months? Are you leaving in 2 months? Not sure. I only know that we are supposed to be ready in 2 months and that no, you cannot come to see me off. I know what you're thinking. Mary and I spent the weekend together. She looked forward to the next stage in her life, and there was nothing I could say or do to change her eagerness to embark on this new venture. At the end of the weekend, I was not sure I wanted to try. I continued to stay in contact with Mary over the next 2 months. After that, her phone was no longer in service. I have not seen Mary since that weekend. When I returned to Phoenix 6 months later, another woman sat at her desk. When I inquired about Mary, I was told that she had moved away. She did not leave a forwarding address. For months, I could not get Mary out of my mind. Every time the phone rang, I expected to hear her voice on the other end. The call never came. I have repeatedly asked people who knew her if they have ever heard from her. I even went to Pearl's ancestral village, but no one had seen her. When I look at the stars at night, I think of Mary, Sherry, and Pearl and a world inhabited by women. That is when I try to imagine a world without men. The truth is, I like and respect the men in my world and could not imagine being happy without them in my life. Unquote. As we come to a conclusion of this week's episode, we should perhaps reflect on the range of consciousness we see exemplified in these different accounts, different kinds of beings with different kinds of agendas, demonstrating perhaps different levels of evolutionary maturity. And again, much of this maturity is around recognizing other sentient life as being part of the interconnected conscious cosmos. And on that note, just recently, it's interesting that various scientists around the world have made the argument that different kinds of life on our planet, animal life, even insect life, should be recognized as conscious and sentient, and that therefore this should dictate our behavior towards our fellow creatures on this planet. In light of what we heard about today in these accounts, I think we can easily make the case that the reason why we haven't considered other creatures as worthy of respect and sovereignty is because we are used to being at the top of the so-called food chain. In light of these accounts today, though, it becomes clear that we're somewhere in the middle ourselves. And again, if we want to be regarded with respect by some of these other beings, then perhaps we should first demonstrate this in our behavior towards our fellow creatures right here on planet Earth. And on that note, we've come to the close of another edition of the Point of Convergence podcast. If you'd like to support this podcast, you can do so by going to patreon.com/exoacademian or by subscribing on Spotify. But until next time, friends, from deep within the Blue Ridge Mountains of North Carolina, this is Exoacademian signing out.